it's just so fascinating to me, these men who are like, oh, tough exterior and I'm aloof. And then you get them in a stadium and you're like, I'm sorry, you have so much unaddressed emotion beneath the surface. Can we explore that at halftime? Like, what's going on here?
It is good to be back in the saddle, as always, with two of my favorite people on the planet, Chantel Baylo, Betsy Bloom. Ladies, it's good to see you. How are you coming into this? Let's set the scene here. How are you doing, Chantel?
I'm good. I'm excited for this conversation.
And Chantel, you emailed a great idea the other day, and it was on the heels of the Super Bowl lost by the Niners. This notion of sports fan loyalty and parenting, there's a lot to get into here, but like, give us, before we dive in, kind of give us the lay of the land, the Cliff's Notes of this topic that's been on your mind.
So I live in the Bay Area. I have a son in particular, an 11-year-old who is a rabid Niners fan. My husband also grew up in the Bay Area, finds the Niners, you know, very beloved fan as well. I have two daughters who enjoy football, but are not quite as obsessed. The Super Bowl obviously did not end in the way that members of my family had hoped. The next morning, my 11-year-old son, still very morose, deep grief, and just turns to me and is like, Mom, I don't have to go to school today, do I? And I was disoriented. I am not a rabid sports fan. It is confusing to me that that question would be raised of whether or not you go to school. And he proceeded to, you know, spend some time sobbing and then pulled himself together in order to face the music. And it was like an anthropological study of, I'm like, wait, what is happening? And it feels like being a fan and loyal to a team is a real emotional roller coaster ride. And why do people put themselves through this? Mm. So I'm excited to explore more.
Yeah, I love this. How long did it take for him to sort of recover and get back to?
I mean, okay. I would say within a couple of days. I think he came home from school that day in disbelief that other people were not rattled. Like,
to could hit, still just, you know, go to school and learn. And
yeah, still go to school. Like, luckily, there's another fourth grade teacher that he could really bond with who felt that deep loss and grief that he did. But it's almost this like, wait, other people are like walking through the day and able to focus on what the teacher is saying. So felt some disconnection. But ultimately, I think, you know, a couple days later, you know, he was somewhat back to normal.
So I think there is a lot here. And we should probably point out that we're going to have Lisa McCaffrey back on next week to do the Super Bowl moratorium. And, you know, I talked to her the other day and it's real. Obviously, she's more connected to it in a different way than your son.
My son would beg to differ. He thinks he's equally as connected as Lisa McCaffrey. But friends,
that
point, we know that's not
true. I think
true.
It is so real. Another friend of mine who lives in Chicago, and like his son, you know, they're Bears fans. Like, they're not, but this kid, he's a Christian McCaffrey fan. He was cheering for the Niners. I don't even think the Niners are his team, but he really wanted the Niners to win the Super Bowl. And he sent me a video of him afterwards. And this kid, he was inconsolable. Like, it was like he was saying, you know, like, they're losers and now I feel like a loser. And I mean, it was just like he could not pull himself out of it. So it's funny because I got to thinking, you know, why is it that your question is spot on, Chantel? Why is it, if you really step back and think about it, when you go to a big sporting event, especially like a playoff or a Super Bowl type game, and you look around and you're like, yeah, there are all of these people who paid so much money, who so badly want this outcome, that have zero impact on the actual outcome, right? Like, loud fans can help, right? Like, yeah, that's a thing. But for the most part, there is nothing that your son or I or you or any of us could do to actually change the outcome of a sporting event. And yet, if our team wins, like, we're celebrating, we're partying, we won,
right?
Like, we won. And when you lose, it is just, you feel like a loser. Like, you just feel it's, the devastation is as real for you. And Chantel, part of this conversation that is probably important to, and you alluded to it, but what was your relationship like with sports growing up? Did you play? Did you watch? Did you care about sports at all?
So I grew up a big chunk of my childhood abroad in England. And so I'm the youngest of three daughters. I say that because I also think that there can be a gender divide along sports fan lines as well. Not exclusively, of course, but I think that's kind of an interesting thing to maybe pull on the thread of during this conversation. So I'm the youngest of three girls. We all played sports. And I would say the main reason that I played sports was I loved being with friends and I liked being on a team. I was rarely part of a winning team. I was benched for virtually the entire basketball season when my coach then said to me, Chantal, you have the height, but so clearly was lacking in some key skill and talent, but I really enjoyed it. I liked being active. I liked being with friends. My dad, you know, paid a premium to get a special cable subscription to be able to watch American football in England, would stay up late because obviously kind of with the time difference, and he stayed up alone. No one else watched it. And so sports was kind of in and around us, but we rarely went to live sporting events. But I'm now in a situation where I have three kids, all of whom are very sporty and want to be engaged athletically. My husband coaches a lot. And I have, I think I have four nieces and nephews, maybe five, who have been or are collegiate athletes. So in my kind of world, it is very present of the power of sports. And I both get it and completely don't.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And as someone who loves it and gets it, there are times that I'm like, what are we doing? Like, what are we doing here? Here is my, I'll give you my, so I grew up playing sports. I love sports. You know, I give my dad a lot of credit about when people ask me like, well, how did you, you know, this is a question, by the way, that men in sports broadcasting never get, but I get asked this quite a lot, as I'll do my female colleagues. How did you get into sports? Like when did you start liking sports? But I played, you know, basketball and I ran track and volleyball and soccer and all the things growing up. And I loved what playing sports did, which is probably another, you know, that's like a related but separate conversation about what playing sports can do for someone. But I, you know, Chantal, what you said about, you know, staying up and watching games, like that was the connective tissue with my dad and I. And I think about my rough years in like, you know, late adolescence, high school, when, you know, I was convinced that my parents were trying to ruin my life and didn't understand me and like wanted me to never have fun or have friends, or which none of that was obviously true, but that was very much what I felt like was happening. And it was it was sports that kept my dad and I connected. We watched football together. It was the language that we spoke.
And it's a neutral language, really, right?
Yes.
It's a common neutral language that's really powerful and bonding.
Right. And I look up to him because he taught me the majority of what I know about sports. I mean, I would ask him the dumbest questions. I think about all those moments and times that we had, and it was, you know, he went to Notre Dame. So going to Notre Dame football games when I was little, like that was really special. So I think that what I love about sports, both as a fan and as, you know, someone who played sports, is that it connects people. It's when you're playing a sport, there is the teammate bond that is so real. There's a great, and I actually have it written down on my desk right here. I went to the University of Washington to do a feature on their softball team a few years ago. Heather Tarr is the coach there. She's amazing. And she had like this giant sign when you walk into the locker room that says, "Never again in your life will you compete with this group of people for a common goal." Mm. And I think you can apply that to so many things, right? Like I think about it in my work that I do now. I think about it in relation to family and friends. Like you just at any moment in any season of your life, there's a group of people that you're working with towards a common goal that will never be the same again. So I think sports connects people, which we talk about all the time about the power of story to connect people. And sports is exactly that as well. But I think it's funny. I did my senior thesis my grad school thesis when I was at Boston University. I did it on the intersection of sports and religion. Mm-hmm. And I went out to Notre Dame.
Oh, wow.
And I did a whole, if I could find that tape, we should probably burn it because I'm sure it's not nearly as good as I thought it was back in the day. But it was basically this notion of, and I interviewed some of the priests, I interviewed like a bunch of different people on campus, you know, football players, fans, people in the dorms. Like, what is it, especially at Notre Dame, which is sort of the nexus of sports and religion? What is it? And I think that ultimately it comes down to, and I was trying to go back and find my old script, but like the main point was, it's the ritualistic nature of A, feeling like you're connected to something bigger than yourself, right? Like when you go to a Notre Dame football game or any football game, there are all of these people who are strangers who you all believe and love the same thing, which is very similar to, you know, when people go to church, probably on some level. And then it's like the ritualistic nature of, you just know what to expect. There are certain game day traditions. Like, you know, we'd go to the Notre Dame game and we'd go to the quad and we'd get a steak sandwich. We'd go and we'd, you know, listen to the drum line and the band would come through and the team would do the walkthrough. There are all these things that you like really looked forward to that were expected and ritualistic. And so, and then kind of the buildup to the different things. So I think, you know, it's funny to be having this conversation now and looking back at when I was trying to come up with a 10-minute, you know, story to finish off my grad program at BU. It's connecting the same thing. It is like sports are the ultimate connector, and it makes you feel something. And much of what I feel about story is what sports are. So yeah. That's my very long-winded answer.
But okay.
That's,
oh my, I have so many reflections in response. First of all, I don't know if we've connected on this. My mom grew up in South Bend, Indiana, dated some
players,
so we can talk about that separately. And just shout out to my nephew, his Georgetown lacrosse team just beat number one ranked Notre Dame on Sunday. So amazing. Go Georgetown.
That's awesome.
Anyway, so that's an aside. See, I can celebrate sports. And here's what it brings up for me as I listen to you, right? I think this religion sport intersection is so fascinating. A, the ritual, B, right? Having a congregation of sorts, right? People who, there's this self-selection. We all believe this. So you don't have to kind of muddle through to figure out, are these my people or not? You know, at a foundational level, I can connect with these folks. The other thing I think it does is it gives, I'm going to say this in a way that help me with it, but it's something along the lines of, it gives you permission to emote. And this is where I think the gender piece comes in, where when I first started dating my husband, I was like, this is good. We have a good balance because I have a lot of emotion. You know, I'm like, I got highs, I got lows, and he is even Steven. And then early on in our dating, when he and I were watching a UCLA basketball game, I was like, oh, you can totally emote. You have deep emotions that are repressed, and then they come out when you are enraged by a call. And I think the same for my son. And this is where I'm like, oh, I love this, that there is an outlet in this, what can be a hyper-masculine, you know, kind of orientation around how you're supposed to be as a boy or a man. And sports gives this permission to cry, to express joy, to have like unadulterated passion, when oftentimes that's subsumed because it's somehow not appropriate. So that's the part of it that I really love. But then, similar to religion, right, if there's a shadow side to everything, sometimes my challenges with religion is, do we become lemmings? Do we kind of fall under this hypnosis of what we are taught to believe because we are raised in it? Another small anecdote, when my husband and I were dating early on, and, you know, for sports games, he would put on the appropriate jersey. And I had never grown up with that, right? And I was like, why are you wearing that? Like, you're not on the team. Like, this is really weird. Like, take that jersey off. Just like wear normal clothing. It was completely bizarre to me that you would dress up. It was like a costume, like you put on gear. So like I hid it for a period of time because I was like, I think this is so weird. And he was obviously very offended. I have come to understand, oh, this is like part of the ritual of like this visual identification of, I'm with this team. But I think the other part of it that I have a problem with is, it almost feels like people are under a spell. And I want to be like, but why are we doing this? And what's really going on here? And have we lost our sense of like what we're doing and what we're
doing? Yes to all of that. And I will say, I have a lot of feelings around, and Lisa and I've talked about this before, grown men wearing jerseys, like whether that could be a whole separate podcast probably. So I'm on your side, Chantal, like hide totally. Those, but you know,
And as another side note, I find it particularly odd that in baseball, the ritual is that the coach, I guess they're the managers, is that what they're called? They wear the uniform. But basketball, you wear a suit, or not all the time, just for college. Like these norms of like coaches sometimes wear the uniform. I'm like, why are you wearing a baseball uniform?
We have Chris's whole thing. My husband's whole thing is like, we should, in every sport, how great would it be if it was like baseball, where the coach had to wear the uniform. Like, can you imagine?
Football. I want
be,
that for
basketball would you. Be hilarious. Like any of it.
Full gear.
Just wearing basketball shorts.
Right. But you just take it as normal because right. it's like, this is yeah. the ritual of the sport. And I'm like, but as a person not familiar with this, sense. This is so odd to
yeah,
me.
It makes
but,
no
okay,
sense.
We're going to go.
Yeah.
With it.
I think this is all true. The part about the emotions are, that is really real. And I think that it is, it's an outlet. And one of my, a guy who I've worked with in the past, who's at Fox, who's been a good friend and kind of mentor to mine. He always says, he goes, I remind people all the time that our jobs are people's release. Like what we do for a living is what people try to escape their lives from, right or wrong, right? Like when people come and watch football on a Sunday, it is their escape. And so, and it's, it, you know, it's the larger point that he's usually making is like, we should be and make sure that you're always enjoying it. So I do think that it is a release and an outlet for emotion and just kind of an escape. I think that is really real. But I do think there is the other side of it. And I think, you know, after the Niners lost, and again, it's different. You know, when I talked to Lisa, she's like, oh man, it took me like a week to sort of, but I'm better. But like, boy, it was rough. That I understand, like the emotional yeah. buildup and the investment, of course it should take a week, if not longer, to right. recover.
You're the mother of like a player. Of the star. I mean, this yeah. is completely
so that is all.
Yes.
And then you look at maybe your son or other people or friends of mine who are, you know, like I'm doing kindergarten or first grade pickup and I see a friend of mine who I know is, a you know, the dad of one of my son's friends and he's like, he's just not right. Like you can tell he is.
Lumber. Yeah. He's
not. And it was a week later. And I was like, hey, how you doing? And he's like, I'm just getting to the point that I can talk about it, but like, I actually never want to talk about it again. Like I've told my wife, we're just never going to talk about that game again. And I'm like, wow. Okay.
Well, and if I were going to yeah. go into some deep, unwarranted right. psychology, but it's misplaced, right? There is something else going on that is creating pain, discomfort, something. And again, I think at its best, sports allows us to redirect that and kind of, it is an outlet for the emotion that we feel. Yeah. I think a part of me though, right? If so much of the work that I do is about helping people to understand their emotional state and then make conscious choices around what you do with that. And in some ways I feel like because sports provides that outlet as a generalization to a lot of men, because men oftentimes are taught in many ways to contain their emotional state. So then sports becomes this profound outlet. And then I worry, I'm like, but I don't know that then we're teaching the skills for in other areas of your life, how are you productively expressing those emotions and managing them and noticing them? Because sports almost becomes this covert way of, well, I'll just rely on that as a way of expressing.
I think you're nailing it all. I think you're exactly right. And what, you know, there's so much here and there's so many different layers to all of this, but I think about, something that Andrew Luck, he was giving a keynote speech at this event that I was at in the summer. And he was talking about how the playing sports is, it allows you to, like, it is a beautiful system and that it is set up so that you fail. Like it is set up so that you learn how to deal with failure. It's the system in which like you are going to fail. And that is part yeah. of it. Like that is built in. You are never going to be successful 100% of the time. You are going to fail more often than you succeed. And you yeah. have teammates and a coach who pick you up and make adjustments and get better. And Andrew's point was, he said, you know, they say that like sports set you up for real life, but we have not built the system outside of sports in many ways, unless you go seek it, to help people through this stuff. And you need it your whole life. So from your perspective, Chantal, like as a coach, when you think about sports in that way, in the role of what you do for work, like, does that bring up something for you or make sense in a different way?
I think you're right. I don't think the systems exist in many ways for, you know, kind of outside and just in general. You know, kind of failure. And do you have the support systems around you as a society? I don't think we do a great job of that. But I will say, looking at my son, who follows all sports all the time, you know, he calls it watching film. So it's not screen time because he's in training by, you know, watching the Warriors basketball game. I mean, it's like he'll watch like college cornhole. Like it doesn't matter as long as there is like some sort of ball in motion for him to pay attention to. And I'm like, oh, there is something though that it, he is building this skill of knowing there will always be another chance. There will always be another chance. So get it. You get to the peak and you're at the nine, you're a Niners player, you're at the Super Bowl. Like, will there be another chance in these immediate players, you know, kind of career? Maybe not, but there's always, there is another game. There's another opportunity. And so I think it does at its best, it can almost wire your brain to remember it is short term. There is another opportunity, and to kind of the stakes maybe feel slightly less high. That's not to say he wasn't devastated and that every loss doesn't wear on him, but you know, with the amount of baseball games and basketball games that there are, you can kind of rebound a little bit more quickly, potentially. Yeah. So that's kind of one thought that comes to mind that I think, again, that is a coaching tactic of how do we gain perspective around how high the stakes really are. They're actually in real life. There always will be something else that will come up. You fail at one thing, there's an opportunity somewhere else. And so almost how to widen the aperture and see it a little bit more clearly. The other thing that was coming up for me, though, as you were talking, and again, I think this comparison with religion is so fascinating. So may we connect your, you know, dissertation in the show notes. But is also this idea around winning and losing, where like that's not a part of religion. And that's also the part that I don't totally understand, because I get drama. Like, I love a good book. I love a good TV show. I get that sports incite this, like, I'm invested in something and I care about these players and their stories. Where I start to not be as engaged is like the stress of winning and losing. I'm like, someone's going to be really bummed and someone's going to be really psyched. And I guess for me, I help me understand, Ashley, why is that appealing? Versus just like the drama where it's like there's nuance of sort of who's.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is the ultimate, and it's one of my favorite, you know, speeches or quotes, but it's like the man in the arena, Theodore Roosevelt's speech in Paris in like 1910. And it starts with, it's not the critic who counts, but the line that I really love, it's the credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, who at the best knows in the end, the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who knew neither victory nor defeat. Like, it is, it should be on everyone's wall, because and that is what I feel deeply, is I'm like, okay, if you're going to fail, like, fail spectacularly, like, go for it. The worst is like standing on the sideline in life, in sports, however you want to put it, like putting yourself out there and risking things and risking great, you know. So why do people, it's like the win and the loss, because the feeling of winning is so good that you're willing to go through all of the losses that come to have that feeling. And it is, I mean, being a fan is different than actually playing. And that's what this whole, you know, Theodore Roosevelt quote is sort of about in my mind.
Yeah.
It actually makes the case for like fandom is ridiculous because you literally are just standing on the sideline.
Exactly. And I'm at its best, it can translate into, oh, see how hard they're working, see how much they're laying it on the line, see. But I think in some ways we have, because there is this whole world of fandom, it almost gives permission to judge from your couch or judge from the sideline versus turning the mirror on yourself to say, what does that mean for me? Like, how am I going to give it my all? How am I going to show up and fail spectacularly? I think that's the other part of it that I struggle with, that it almost creates this, excuse is too harsh of a word, right? I know that fans are just having a good time, but it can sort of be like, oh no, that's their job, not mine.
Chantel, really, you're hitting on something that I think is at the core that I'm glad you brought up, because this is one of the biggest issues, especially with social media now. I know a lot of college athletes. You would not believe the stuff that people will say to these young people on social media, on Twitter, on Instagram, it is disgusting, right? Horrible. Like, I'm just like, what is, like, who hurt you? You know, I'm like, what? You're sitting on your couch or whatever, like, and you're gonna sit. Somebody already feels. I mean, Lisa talks about this all the time. She's like, no one wants it more than the person who's competing, right? Like, these people have put their lives into it.
Absolutely. And their bodies through, and the risk that they're taking.
Then for you to like sit there on, you know, while you're eating your potato chips and like make some whatever it is. But there were some that really got me going on the Stanford women's basketball team. I had some fans who just, and again, I'm like, these women are unbelievable, and they're Stanford students, and they're, and here you are sending the most absurd, offensive, like rude. And yeah. I just think that is where, and that is, it used to be that you could never, fans never had access unless, you know, you'd always yell stuff. There's always fans that yell ridiculous stuff at games. And that was as close as you could get to the athletes. Now with social media, like everybody has access to, they think they do, you know, just directly to these people. And it's exhausting and it's awful. And it's easy to say, don't read it, but it's really hard to not, to be able to completely push it away. So that is one thing that I just feel awful for current athletes, but professional, you know, high schoolers, college kids, like all ages, like it doesn't, you probably get more used to it. And as you're a pro and you're making millions of dollars, it comes with the territory, that criticism. But I'm like, man, that is the ultimate Theodore Roosevelt quote of just like, what are you doing? Like you are sitting on the sidelines.
Well, and it's also the ultimate of sort of like what happens. And again, I think this is where I like to be part of a group, and I like to sometimes be like, well, I'm different from the group. And so I think it plays a little bit into my orientation of, I don't know that I love to be like all in with like a particular group identity. And I think sometimes when we are all in with a particular group identity, like groupthink takes over, right? And suddenly we think that we are entitled to something, or that we say things that we would never say if it were, we didn't kind of feel as though there was this mass behind us. So I think sort of what like anything, right? There's like beauty and gorgeousness in it. And simultaneously there can be this shadow side if we don't pay attention to it. But it's just, it's something I'm so unfamiliar. Like, here's another thing that was sort of shocking to me that maybe will resonate for you, Ashley. And I was talking to my son about this. So my husband like sent me some portion of a Bill Simmons podcast. He's an avid listener. And Bill Simmons was talking about how crazy it is that, I don't know what the current stat is, you know, something like 50% of people get divorced, but no one divorces mm-hmm. their teen. Like, you are loyal to whatever team you were connected to, but people are willing to be like, that wife of mine, that husband of mine,
we have kids together. It's not working out.
So, you know what? Whatever. It's going to be a real doozy financially, but it's worth it. But, I'm sorry. No, I'm a Niners fan or I'm a Warriors fan. Like, nothing would get between me and that, you know? And I was, you know, testing my son to just be like, is there any version where you might imagine becoming a different, you know, to him, it's just incomprehensible. And so again, this sort of this blind loyalty, and it's not blind. It's a part, it has become so much a part of who he is and what he feels connected to, but it's just a bit of a mystery to me when I'm like, well, but all relationships, some evolve or come to an end or need to change or shift. And with fans, that's not the case.
It's interesting you say this. And Betsy, I want to bring you in and ask you about your fandom as a Bills fan, because I think you can probably speak directly to this. Like, you could divorce the Bills if you wanted to. Now, I'm not saying that you should, and they've given you plenty of reasons not to recently, but I think that, well, a perfect example. So I grew up a Broncos fan, right? Like, and I love the Broncos. The best win, the two best wins as a fan that I have ever experienced was in 1998 when they won their first Super Bowl. I was a sophomore in high school, and that was like, oh my, I just remember feeling that was pure euphoria. Like, I just couldn't believe, you know, it was amazing. And I was like, it was also, I think, probably the first time that I had consumed alcohol and watched a sporting event. So that probably maybe helped with the highlighted euphoria, but either way, I remember that being, and then Super Bowl 50, when the Broncos played at Levi Stadium out here in San Francisco or in Santa Clara and beat the Panthers. I was there with my brother and with Alex. And that was, I just remember at the very end, like saying a prayer, because no one thought that the Broncos were going to win. I remember saying a prayer like, God, if the Broncos win this game, I will never ask for a team of mine to win another game again. Like, I will never ask for a single sports related request ever again. Just give me this one. He gave it to me. So I can never complain about, like, I'm never going to be sad, you know, ultimately about another loss again, because I traded all of my equity for that win. And it was totally worth it. But it is, I felt this, different feeling because obviously I've become a 49ers fan living in San Francisco for 12 years. And then really what did it was obviously Christian and Lisa and the connection there. And that's why when people who I, you know, ask me when they find out what I do for a living, they always say, oh, well, who are your favorite teams? Like what team? I'm sure you have a favorite team, you know, in the Pac-12, like who's your favorite team? And I just say, you cheer for people, like you become friends with people or you love people's stories and you pull for them. Like if Christian went to another team, God forbid, I would be a fan of that team. If, you know.
Yeah, but that is an unusual fan.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. It is totally different than, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm sure there's plenty of friends of mine who are like, are you telling me you're a Niners fan now?
Right, because players aren't loyal, right? I mean, players get traded, but fans
I know. Are. And it's the ups and downs. Loyal. So, okay, so Betsy, let's bring you in and last. I want to hear about your, as you've got your Bills shirt on there. What's your relationship with the Bills?
Yeah, well, I think I have a healthy relationship with the Bills. And actually, Chantal, what you brought up, I was thinking about that. I was like, that's such a good point. But I think true loyalty, like a person who truly values loyalty, would also be like, I'm going to stick it out in this relationship in the same way that they would stick it out with their team. Like the people who are sending horrible messages on Instagram, that's not loyalty. Goodbye. That's the opposite of loyalty. Like you're saying when the chips are down, you're not going to be supportive. It's like in sickness and in health, the Bills have had many moments where their fans have had to question that. I will say that my dad divorced the Bills because he emoted so much during that period, the four losses. And he was like, never again. Like, I can't put my heart out there.
His like emotional state couldn't handle it.
Does he watch anymore? Like, does he even watch him or will he watch and just kind of really?
No.
Wow.
He wouldn't attach himself to a different team.
No.
Bills, so he wouldn't remarry if we stick with
care metaphor. About football if it's not the Bills, but he won't watch the game. He'll listen to it because I think he truly like it was too hard for him. But in the way that I was thinking about, like, why are Buffalo fans? Because obviously we have a reputation for being over the top and also very loyal, Bills Mafia. And I think there's a couple of things. One, I think that Buffalo is such a gritty city. And so there's like sort of like a, it's for me being a fan, I love the current Bills. I love Josh Allen, but like, it's about my city. It's about like wanting my city to do well and wanting to have a win because it's not a city that has had a ton of wins in both metaphorical and literal ways. But, there's this documentary, it's called The Four Falls of Buffalo, and it's about those four Super Bowl losses. And my favorite part of the documentary by far is Scott Norwood misses the field goal. He feels horrible. He comes back and there's a giant rally for the Bills in Buffalo and everyone is chanting his name to come out. Like he's like, I'm going to hide. Like they hate me. I'm the most hated person in Buffalo. And it's the whole Town Hall Square is just full of people chanting his name and he comes out and everybody's cheering for him. And that to me, that is the good side of sports. That is the loyalty that shows like they were supporting the man in the arena. Like none of them could have kicked that field goal.
Oh, and to like be in that intense community and supporting a collective goal. I mean, that's amazing, right? It feels so good to be with people in that situation.
Exactly. And like, you know, this year, it's like the same thing every year, like Bills fans get their hearts broken and then they pick their heart up that was like splattered off the floor and put it back in their chest and like smash a table. And so I think that resilience is amazing.
Except for your dad. Your dad was like, I've had enough. The other thing that I really truly do not understand, and I've been in a couple of these situations, once when the Red Sox won the World Series when I was in Boston, and once when the Avs won their first Stanley Cup when I was in Denver. I do not understand a city that wins a championship and burns the city, or like riots and flips cars and destroys stuff. And I'm like, what are we doing here? Like maybe if you lost and you're trying to get out your rage, that is one thing that I truly, that would be a whole nother, we'd have to get like a serious, you know, many psychologists in here to figure out exactly what the hell that is about. Cause it makes no sense to me. There's just so much more that we could go into this on. And I know that we should move on, but I will say, I think the thing that you realize, and I think I can't remember which one of you made the point, but oh yeah, Chantal, about how many times when you suffer losses, and most of the times when you talk to athletes, like they remember the losses way more than they remember the big wins. It's that is such a more of a core emotion that stays with them than the wins and the euphoria. But I think that when I look back on like the most heartbroken, I was talking to Chris about this before we recorded, I'm like, what's the most heartbroken you've been after a loss? And he said, he goes, oh, the time that I cried the most was after my last lacrosse game in college. Like it was, and he goes, and we won, but it was the saddest I ever felt. Cause like, I sort of knew it was over. Yeah.
It was the last time.
And that goes back to just the beauty of sports. And I think for, you know, women and girls in particular, I am super passionate about this. And we did an episode with Bonnie Bernstein that, you know, you should go back and listen to it because she's got a whole thing about it. But, you know, she's doing an entire series on this exact thing. But there was a, you know, an ESPNW study done recently that like 94% of female C-suite executives played sports in their youth. And I just think about who I became. Yeah. And of course, sports is like center to my world. But I just think about the impact that it had on me and my confidence and how to navigate relationships and how to learn and how to all of those things that sometimes can feel like cliched, it is fundamentally core to who I became.
Oh my God. Yes. And and just to like double underline again, having kids who are playing pretty intense sports, I feel like I learned the lessons vaguely, but seeing, you know, when I have a 14-year-old daughter and the idea that, at playing volleyball, being tall and being strong is good. And that is not necessarily what is signaled to teen girls in this era. And so many, both from a character standpoint, a sense of personal responsibility, right? Feeling a real sense of, there is something I need to do. If you're part of a team sport, there is something I need to do to take care of my team. I feel a sense of obligation and responsibility and being part of a collective. I mean, there's so many, I think, incredibly powerful life lessons. And like with anything, how do you tend to it not going into overdrive that then you're getting the downsides of burning down cities or burnout or intense injury or all the other things that I think these experiences also
run. And we will link to, you wrote a terrific blog, Chantal, that I have sent to a lot of people and a lot of friends who have kids who play sports, but it's called The Magic and the Madness of Youth Sports. And I think one of the things, and you're talking about your daughter, right? And all these crazy, I mean, youth sports, period. And this could be, again, a whole nother conversation of like what it's become and how it's so different than when we were growing up and when we were playing, like the level of, it is so intense. The club sports, the travel, the cost, the time away from it, like,
yeah, it's a business that it is, which is really just money right. Motivated praise totally. On parents.
And what you so beautifully lay out in that blog is, you know, I think you talked about like, instead of fixating on like, what the hell are we doing? Cause there's many moments in which I'm sure a lot of parents, like you look around, you're like, what am I doing? Yeah. It's about like taking a step back and trying to figure out like, where's the hidden magic? And I think that is true that's such a beautiful way to think about things, both for youth sports, but you could apply that to any single thing in life. And it's the old ultimate, you know, cliche of like, it's about the journey, not the destination, but it's true. Like it are those little magical moments and connection points that you have with your daughter that are going to be the connective tissue for long beyond, you know, whatever, however long she plays volleyball. I appreciate you guys so much. And like I said, we will have Lisa on, who actually can, you know, speak a little bit more to the true intensity of a loss when you are so emotionally invested and come so close and yet fall short. So we'll see what she has to say and how Christian's doing. That will be next week. But as always, it's a gift to be with both of you.
Totally. Do we want to do a round of quick gratitude?
Let's do a round of quick gratitude. Thank you for reminding me. You go first since you remembered.
All right. Well, in the spirit of sports, and I've been kind of like Wendy Weiner here in terms of the things that maybe how sports brings us down. I am grateful for youth sports. I feel really grateful for, I'll name my husband as a coach. So he's coached all of my kids, softball, basketball, baseball. I really love the intentionality that he brings in actually focusing on How do you develop these little humans? How do you help them to support each other, right? The requirement of whenever someone strikes out, softball or baseball, he requires that everyone is in the dugout, high-fiving and cheering them, to kind of like, how do you instill this sense of, it is hard. It is hard to be up there trying to hit a ball. It is hard taking a shot. And how do you like celebrate versus making people somehow feel bad? So to all the coaches out there who are intentionally trying to develop the hearts and minds of small and big humans, I commend you, because there are incredible life lessons to be taught. Competition matters, and it is the whole person. So that's what I'm grateful for.
Beautifully said. Betsy, how about you?
I think I'm just going to continue with my diehard Buffalo theme and just shout out the city of good neighbors and to tell them to keep trucking. And also, like, we are at our best when we're cheering on Scott Norwood after missing the field goal. So I hope we always stay positive and we keep believing despite the odds.
That, I mean, you should be on like that. That should be, I don't know who the marketing person at the Bills is, but I'm going to send them that clip, and that you're going to be like their new marketing. That's going to be the video. It should be.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really just trying to get hired by the Bills. That's my whole.
The ulterior motive is revealed.
I won't include that part.
I'll be linking my resume in the show notes.
Oh man. I mean, there's so much that is like coming into my brain when I think about a sports related gratitude thing. Like it's been my whole life. I mean, it's sports have been, central to who I have become. And then I think about the biggest thing is the people that it's introduced me to. And I think about some of the coaches in particular. You talk about coaching Chantal, and I'm going to give a shout out to Tara Vanderveer, the Stanford women's basketball coach. She is someone who I just look around and I think, yeah, who went to your same high school, by the way, Betsy, Buffalo Seminary, shout out. Yeah,
there you go.
And every time I'm around her, she is the most normal, easy to talk to human being on the planet. Like, it's just Tara. Like, she's just so, and one of her players said this, and I couldn't have agreed more. She broke the all-time wins record for any college coach. She passed Mike Krzyzewski at Duke for the all-time winningest basketball coach. And we were there. This was a couple months ago. They beat Oregon State. And they had, oh man, dozens and dozens of her former players that were back there. Stanford did such a good job. They threw this huge celebration afterwards in which a lot of them got up on stage and told different stories, and they played all these videos. And I was just sitting there, and I mean, I had like tears in my eyes, and I'm like, I know what a big deal she is. I know how lucky I am that my career overlapped with hers for 12 years. And yet hearing how many people she impacted over 40 years of coaching, it was unbelievable. And I've looked at her completely differently since then. I mean, not completely differently, but like I have just have new level of understanding and deep appreciation and respect for what it takes to stay committed to that craft, to go through all the things that coaches, especially on, you know, in that level goes through, and all the criticism. And I think the coaches out there who are in it for the right reasons and who are helping young people become better versions of themselves, and understanding that everybody kind of needs something a little bit differently, so you have to really get to know your kids and your players. It's one of the best professions, and I think that I am grateful for all of the amazing coaches, but especially Tara Vanderveer that I've gotten to be around. So go Buffalo, though, also. All right. I appreciate you guys so much, and we'll have a lot more coming up. As always, we thank you for listening, and please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I don't know anything about algorithms. I just know that it really helps the show, and you can watch us on YouTube as well and check out our social media. And if you have any sports-related questions for any of us, drop us a line, emailyourmompodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.